Did you know that there are over 3.2 million podcasts in the world? It seems like everybody these days has a podcast. But did you also know that 90% of those podcasts fail to make it to 20 episodes? There are various reasons for these failures, but one reason is that people don't know what they're doing. Shocking, right? As it turns out, the same reason why people don't operate on themselves also applies to podcast success. You want to talk to someone who has had success launching and marketing podcasts. Somebody like Juliana Barbati. Juliana runs a podcast marketing and production agency, and their team takes care of everything for you, making this process a breeze. All their info is in the show notes. You can go to julianabarbati.com, tell them TGFB sent you, and get a discount when paying in Bitcoin. That's right. Juliana is a Bitcoiner. Her and her husband were actually Bitcoiners before they were Christians. And so it's been great for us to work with them. They basically came to us and said, hey, we'd love to help you guys, help TGFB grow. And so we'd love to kind of apply our services to you guys. So go ahead and support them. If you have a podcast you're working on or one that you'd like to start, go ahead and check them out. Now let's get to today's show. Seed Signer, welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm a relatively new listener, but you have rocketed to the top of my personal sort of podcast that I check on when I go to listen to things.
Cool. Man, awesome. Well, I'm glad to hear that. It's helped me, found it helpful and stuff. And
yeah.
Again, yeah, this has been something I've wanted to do for a long time, and you know, the timing worked out for us to be able to do it. So why don't you just kind of introduce yourself maybe for people who are listening to this and don't have any context for who you are or what you do?
So I am a Bitcoiner first and foremost. I'm a NIM online. I kind of pseudonymously and eponymously refer to myself by the project I started. I didn't really have a public presence in the Bitcoin space until I started this do-it-yourself hardware wallet project. Yeah. So I live in the greater St. Louis area here in the United States. So that probably helps provide some context for me. And yeah, I am blessed to have kind of stumbled onto this idea of a DIY signing device that you can build from off-the-shelf parts. And I think it has a lot of value to offer people within the Bitcoin space. It may not be for everyone, and that's okay. But that's what I work on day to day. That's what I get up in the morning and get excited about, is kind of sharing this with other people. And that's kind of been a curiosity as time goes on, is like, it surprises even me. Like, I get up and I'm the public face of the project. So I run the Twitter account that tries to share information about the device and developments with our platform. And I'm kind of the, I don't think shelling point is the right word, but I'm kind of the coordination point for the project. So people who are interested and want to ask how they can contribute, or if they have questions about how it works, or I'm kind of the central point that everybody comes to find what they need. I'm also a stay-at-home dad, which is sort of comical, because my wife has been extremely understanding about how this is, this sort of project has co-opted a lot of my life and taken up a lot of my time and energy. So
yeah,
that's kind of like a brief overview of me.
Yeah. So kind of what's your background, if you don't mind me asking? Like, growing up, what did things look like?
In terms of the greater St. Louis area, I'm what you'd call a lifer.
Okay.
I was born here and grew up in a relatively large Catholic family. I'm the baby, so I kind of have that entertainer aspect of my personality, maybe, that a lot of us people who had significantly older brothers and sisters take on. And you can say I did 12 years in Catholic school as I was growing up, and always kind of had this, I don't know, like, my journey through Catholic school is not exactly easy, but I was the kid in religion class who, as they're talking about Catholic catechism and stuff like that, and the ethical piece of it and all, I'm the one looking around at the other kids saying, like, you guys getting this? Like, we all just kind of abide by this sort of moral system and like everything will be great. So I've always kind of just had this sort of, I don't know, when I was younger, I thought I was going to become a priest for a while.
Oh, really?
And that was kind of up until puberty, and you discover girls, and that kind of gets distracting and takes you on a different thing. But I actually, back then, there was a high school in the St. Louis area that was kind of like the place you went if you were thinking about becoming a priest.
Okay.
And it's so interesting. In St. Louis, we have a very strong parochial high school system.
Yeah.
And most people, like, the transition from going from a Catholic elementary school to a Catholic high school is a preview of the college application process, because you have to submit applications to your schools of choice, and your GPA matters. And a lot of the schools have an interview with, if not the school administrator, you know, the admissions counselor or something like that.
Sure.
And certain schools can only accept so many people. So that's this competitive application process. And I had applied to a local school that was this kind of like pre-step before you considered going into the seminary.
Sure.
And unfortunately for me, in the spring of my eighth grade year, that school closed because declining, you know, enrollment, and it was, I'm sure, expensive for the archdiocese to operate.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so at this point, late in the application process, when pretty much all the schools have accepted who they're going to take, it's like, oh, by the way, the school you were planning on going to and that you'd been accepted to closed.
Yeah.
And so it was thrown into this like tailspin. So that why I bring this up is that was maybe another sign along the way that the priesthood maybe wasn't in my path.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Let me just ask you, what was it about being a priest that like, did you have, were there priests in your life who you saw and were ministered to by, and you said, man, I really appreciate what they're doing. I'd love to do something like that. Like, what was it that you think like drew you to being interested in that?
So it's partly, I guess, in my upbringing. So my mother had kind of an unfortunate childhood. Her own mother died when she was, I believe, like 4, 5, 6 years old.
Wow.
And so her father was not like the most responsible guy. It was her and two older brothers. And I think he just kind of acknowledged that he either didn't have what it took or didn't want to have what it took to raise them. So after her mother died, her and her brothers went to an orphanage, like big room full of beds, nuns everywhere, orphanage, where she bounced in and out of that orphanage as she grew up. Some of her relatives took her and her brothers on as foster children for some of her growing up, but then she would end up back at the orphanage because, you know, it was a temporary arrangement. Anyhow, so my mother was basically raised by nuns.
Wow.
And so wow. She has this deep spirituality that I think in part just rubbed off on me, like osmosis, just being around her.
Yeah.
And maybe some people are just wired for it. It was actually like, to get a little bit deeper into it, so I also grew up during what was kind of the core of the child abuse scandals within the Catholic Church. So when you ask if there were specific priests that I knew growing up, two priests that were in the parish that I grew up in were actually like prosecuted and ended up in prison.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So, which I didn't know when I was going through this kind of like almost formational period of my life. But it was, to get back to your original question, I think I may have just some natural wiring for that, that predisposed me to being more in tune with my faith and my spiritual side. I think part of it is I have this ethos for service, which is also kind of what led me into law enforcement, you know, which is a pretty different pursuit, but not altogether unrelated.
No.
Yeah. That was, I guess, to answer your kind of question, I've always had kind of this calling to be of service to others. And that it's like when maybe a part of it is like when you're a third grade girl and you've just had exposure to teachers your whole life, you want to be a teacher.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
And so I didn't have, you know, a lot of male teachers. And when I was a kid, I did have interactions with a lot of priests in the course of, you know, my schooling. Yeah. So maybe it's just something you naturally think of until, you know, for some reason it gets ruled out.
Yeah. I think it totally makes sense. I was just talking to, we were at a friend's house last night, my wife and I, and my wife was telling them that our third child, second son, he said to her the other day, "Mom, I either want to be a soldier or a fireman." And basically, and like he had told a friend of ours who's a fireman, we went to the fire station and like he told the guy that he's like, you know, that he would be a fireman. Like, you know, he'd be willing to do it and like took it seriously. And so it's definitely, it was because there's two guys in his life. One is this guy who's a fireman who he just really looks up to and thinks it's, you know, really cool. And then there's another guy who's in the military, who's a good friend of mine, who's really like invested in him and just like cared about him and spent time with him and stuff. And so definitely the people who take an interest in you and are willing to dedicate time or invest time in you, you know, you're going to be more interested, I think, and willing to consider the possibility of, hey, maybe I should be like him in other ways, you know?
Yeah. We're a product of like the nature versus nurture balance of the experiences that we have access to. And then I am the father of twins and I have boy girl twins.
Congrats.
Who are, thank you, my first two kids. And I didn't really know how much stock to put into the nature side of things until I got to observe them firsthand.
Yeah.
And obviously they're boy, girl, but I would like to think that they were raised in generally the same environment. And that we treated them roughly the same way, but they are just like, you know, yin and yang in terms of personalities. So there is something to that nature stuff for sure.
Yeah. I mean, do you see a big difference between the boy and the girl? Like, is there just like night and day difference in what they're interested in, or is it on a different level?
Yeah. And it's, you don't know, like, whether it's us trying to fit the perception into a certain paradigm, but like the way it's kind of evolved is my daughter is more similar to me, and my son, who's the twin, seems to be much more similar to his mother.
Yeah.
And my wife and I are different people too. And it's just, my daughter's very strong-willed, very independent, to the point that it causes friction in relationships because she thinks she knows how other people should be acting. And I can admit that sometimes I fall victim to that too.
Yep.
And my son is much more easygoing, not always needing to be doing something. They're just totally different people. It's been an interesting journey.
Yep. That's interesting. Okay. So you graduate high school, you end up not going into the seminary. What did you end up, if you don't mind me asking, like, what did you end up studying and getting into beyond that? Or did you go right to, you mentioned law enforcement?
No, law enforcement was like a meandering journey to that. So I originally thought I wanted to be an engineer. I always, like, when I was a kid, I kind of like just built stuff in my backyard back when you could, I guess, still do that kind of thing. I don't know about your childhood, but like, it's probably roughly similar to mine in that, like, my parents were old school. They were a little bit older than when they had me. They were in their later 30s when I was born. And I was a product of this very old school kind of approach to raising children, and that it was part like children should be seen and not heard.
Mm-hmm.
And also to some degree that children, I think, were almost kind of disposable. An older generation, like, you could just say, I'm leaving in the morning and you're gone for the entire day. As long as you're back by dinner and there were no contacts with law enforcement or you didn't get in trouble with any other kids' parents, like, it was like you did what you did. So I thought I was going to be an engineer, and I actually applied to a good university here in Missouri that specializes in science and technology, got accepted. I was a reasonably good student. And then I think it was the latter part of junior year, I got hijacked by this really good English teacher at the high school I was going to, and probably like watching the movie Dead Poets Society. I think I have a little bit of an inner romantic.
Yeah.
And suddenly decided that like being an English teacher in high school would be like the greatest thing. It's probably a part of that, like the people you're exposed to, you know, shape how you see yourself in the future. And so I switched up my college applications and applied to a different school and ended up at a small liberal arts school in northern Missouri, studying English with a minor in philosophy.
Okay.
And went through college, you know, did reasonably well, graduated a little bit early, and came out of college and thought that I'm going to go on this path to getting a master's degree in teaching. And then, you know, in Missouri, you have to become state certified too, which is kind of packaged in with the process. So I started that degree program and got two semesters into it and just realized after doing some like in-class observations, and the catalyst was I had actually gotten hired as an English teacher by a school in the St. Louis area. And so I'm two semesters into my Master of Arts in Teaching program. I have a bachelor's degree in English. And there was a school, a Catholic parochial high school here in the St. Louis area that had an unfortunate situation where a teacher was forced to leave in the middle of the school year and they were looking for someone to finish out the school year.
Huh.
And there's some wiggle room because it's a private school, so you don't have to have the Missouri teaching certificate to be able to teach in their system.
Yeah.
And so while I am not always great at interviews, I must have like done decently at that one because here I am at like 23 or 24 years old and I managed to somehow talk myself into a job teaching high school.
Wow.
But I never even made it to the first day in the classroom. So I think I probably got hired in later November when they found out that this teacher was going to have to leave, got offered this job. And so I started putting together a curriculum and it was just constant. I thought I'm going to stick with nuts and bolts and grammar and like, we're going to keep it simple until I, you know, we'll do the literature too. But anyhow, during the negotiation process with the faculty advisor and the administration over the curriculum I was planning, it became immediately apparent to me that I wasn't ready for this and maybe it wasn't the right path for me to begin with at all.
Did this turn into you had Dead Poets Society like arguments with the faculty over the curriculum?
Yeah, I can imagine that happening.
Yeah.
No, it was just kind of this like realization over 2 weeks of you know, a lot of what went from starting to plan a curriculum into like a lot of soul searching.
Yeah.
And thinking like, is this really the life for me? Because part of it was, I don't think I had a realistic impression of how much time and energy that teachers put into their class. Obviously, all the lesson planning that goes into it. Yeah. And when you're in a literature teacher, you have all of the recreational reading that goes into it. I've never been a great reader. It's ironic for, you know, having a degree in English. And so at the end of this 2-week period, I was just like, I don't think this is for me, and had this kind of like blow up month where it was like, I'm withdrawing from the Master of Art in Teaching program, and I'm going to turn down this job offer responsibly so that they have enough time to find somebody else.
Yeah.
But then it's like, okay, so I have a bachelor's degree in English. I don't have any real practical skills. Like, what am I going to do with my life from this point on?
You're still single at this point.
Yeah. Still very single.
Gotcha.
And having, like, you know, after college, moved back in with my parents because I was continuing my education and was doing it closer back to St. Louis where I was from. And so I am literally looking in the want ads in the newspaper for like, what's the next chapter of my life?
Yeah.
And found an ad that TWA was hiring flight attendants.
Huh.
And so on a super cold, I think it was a January morning, I go to a mass interview sort of event that they're holding. And I'll never forget it. As I'm walking up the steps to TWA, was this, depending on your age, you may or may not have heard of them, but they were one of the first original large airlines.
Yep.
And as I'm walking up the stairs of the TWA training center, which is was based here in St. Louis, the front page headline of the Post-Dispatch was TWA declares bankruptcy. And so time when they had kind of like gone through Carl Icahn, who's financial guy, had done like a hostile takeover, I think, of the company, and they'd pushed him out and they were trying to bring the company back as kind of like an employee owned thing, and it wasn't working. And so TWA goes bankrupt and they're going for sale. So we go into these interviews and the interviewers are like emphatic, like, we're just continuing today like we would any other day. There's an obvious story in the press, but we still need to hire people and we still are flying planes. So we're going on with this. So went through, it's like a panel interview process and whatever. And so I get hired on to be a flight attendant, and I go through, I think it was 6 weeks of training, and then you are assigned to some flights, and it was just an interesting sort of thing to do when you're young and goofy. And I wanted to kind of see different places, and flying around the country with some pretty girls seemed like not a bad gig. So I was a flight attendant from roughly like February of 2001 till after 9/11.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So I was in a plane on 9/11, and we were flying out of actually Atlanta, Georgia.
No.
That
way.
Morning.
Wow.
And I was on a flight from Atlanta to St. Louis. Fortunately, we were close enough to St. Louis that when everything started going down, we were permitted to continue on and land in St. Louis. But that was still an interesting experience. Just the same kind of like being in the air on 9/11 and being in an airport on 9/11 was crazy. And then kind of things, being a working flight attendant, as they were trying to return the air travel system to normal, like the first week was just like, they were running the flights because they wanted to get back in the routine of having flights. But for several flights, there was only like 2 or 3 passengers on the plane. Yeah. It was just a weird environment. And then TWA, as I mentioned, was in bankruptcy, and they ultimately were acquired by American Airlines. And in the process of merging the two companies, like, most of the TWA flight attendants got laid off because the air travel industry was going through this, you know, crazy tumultuous period because of 9/11 and everything. And so I got laid off, I think, in October or November of 2001. And so now I'm back at this point where it's like, again, I'm trying to be adulting here and I don't have any real skill. And so I fell back on security. So I previously, to kind of jump backwards a little bit, when I was in college, I had a job at a local theater, a summer job working in a concession stand at a local theater. And it was an evening job, and I was looking for a day job too because I wasn't doing anything during the day. And I just happened to be working with this guy who worked as a security guard at the St. Louis Zoo, which is also in the same kind of general vicinity where this outdoor theater that I was working at. And so the following summer, which I think was my sophomore year of college, this guy got me a job as a security officer at the St. Louis Zoo. Wow. And so one of the best jobs I've ever had. They just kind of, at that point, they handed you a walkie-talkie in the morning and like the zoo is your oyster. You could just walk around anywhere you wanted. And you, throughout the day, you help find lost kids and tell people not to lean over railings and just kind of like whatever. But probably the influential part of that job was I was a part-time security officer, but they had this full-time role that was a zoo ranger. And almost all of the zoo rangers were retired St. Louis City cops.
Yeah.
Because the zoo itself is, I believe, operated by the city of St. Louis. So it was kind of this semi-retirement thing that once you put in enough years in the Metropolitan Police Department, a lot of these guys came to the zoo, which was kind of their low-key retirement gig, you know, just driving around the zoo in a golf cart kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I got drawn into this world of like, you know, hearing all these guys having just the stories they were telling me were from like the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
When it was still like you were a cowboy out there, you know, on the streets of St. Louis, and there wasn't nearly as much oversight as there is in law enforcement these days. And so for better and for worse, it was just a more exciting job. And so when I went back to college that fall, I was, you know, looking for a job up at college, and the campus police department had a similar role where they had student officers that, you know, didn't respond to like calls that were remotely, you know, it was your job was to lock up the buildings, or if a, you know, a girl needed an escort across campus or stuff like that, you were just kind of this like security guy who had keys to campus and locked up the buildings on a certain schedule and just kind of generally were a uniform presence on campus, eyes and ears of the actual full-time police officers. Sure. So when I get laid off from TWA, it's like, I'm back to this, like, what am I going to fall back on? And so I think it was in the paper again, I saw that a local university was hiring security people. And so I have a little bit of a background in private security. So it was somewhat of a match with my, you know, experience. And so I went to an interview and got hired on as a private security guard with this local university. And one of the advantages of going to working at the university was that you could take classes. I already had a bachelor's degree, but I was actually curious about studying computers at that point. And I wanted to pursue some sort of course of studying computers. So instead of getting another bachelor's degree, which really wouldn't have made sense at a Catholic university because you have to take theology and all this kind of stuff. And I didn't want to have to do a lot of those electives. I wanted just the meat and potatoes. So I went through a professional degree program that was basically like going through another bachelor's degree where you take all of the courses in the major and focus on the subject matter. So I went through a course in management information systems, which is kind of like the business cousin to a computer science degree. You don't go as deep into the math or the number systems, and it's computer science more for a business focused audience where you learn kind of a little bit of everything about networking and databases and some programming and, you know, system design and that kind of stuff. And so I completed that certificate program and felt like I got like a decent survey of computer science, but I'm also, my job at that point is a security officer, and I'm again working with a lot of retired police officers.
Yeah.
And so the university I was working in was not in the best neighborhood. And I'm kind of thinking about like, what's the next, I got bit by the law enforcement bug.
Yeah.
And so I realized that if I got into the police academy, I could probably have maybe a less dangerous job making more money. Because the university I was working at was a very urban environment, and there was a lot of, we were busy in terms of just crime that was happening adjacent to campus and to some degree on campus. So I decided that I'm going to start applying to be a police officer. And the way that it works is that you can apply directly with apartments, police departments, or the police academy that I went to had what was called an open enrollment program, where it's kind of a program to where you are not being hired by any police agency with some sort of screening. If you meet their criteria, you can go through the police academy for free. And at the end of it, presumably, if you finished it, you're appealing to a police agency, because the way it works is a lot of police departments hire someone before they've gone through the police academy.
Yeah.
So while they go through the police academy, which is like a, it was 6 months when I did it. I think it's closer to eight now. They pay this person a salary the whole time that they're going through the police academy, hoping that they make it through and then ultimately that they'll be a suitable police officer.
Yeah. They've paid this guy for nothing, basically.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So if you've made it through the police academy on your own, like you're kind of an appealing candidate because you've already proven that you can get through it. You have some degree of interest and skill and all that.
Yeah.
So I was accepted into this open enrollment program, but it's tricky because, you know, for 6 months, I don't have a salary. And I, by that point, I had purchased a small condo And so I had a mortgage, you know, I have bills, I have to eat. And so I've always been kind of, you know, financially responsible. And so I'd saved up enough money to make sure that I had enough money to pay the mortgage and go to the grocery store and all this kind of stuff. So I was unemployed, went through the police academy for 6 months and got through the police academy. And I'm not a great interview as a cop. For whatever reason, I have a lot of respect for cops and I get nervous in police interviews. And so I went through a number of interviews before an agency, I think, saw something in me and decided, like, you know, this guy would fit in well for us. So within a month of completing the police academy, I got picked up by an agency and that's it. Like, you're out there living the dream, driving a police car. I think for the first 3 months, you're on what's called field training, which means you don't ever go out by yourself. Yeah. You're with a field training officer and they teach you kind of the nuts and bolts of, you've learned the theory of everything in the police academy. Now we're going to get down to like how things really work when you're out there on your own. So for 3 years, you know, I made it through field training and blah, blah, blah. And for 3 years, I was a cop, just kind of like running traffic, answering calls, writing reports. I worked for a small agency in the suburbs. So you do everything from, you know, writing police reports for a theft out of someone's house to a traffic accident to responding to fight in progress to you know, all this kind of stuff. And then a little less than 3 years in, the chief at the agency I worked for was a little bit of a geek, like a computer nerd. And he knew from my application that I had this background where I'd studied computers while I was security guard. And I was a tinkerer before that growing up, just kind of like, was always fascinated by computers. So there's this local computer forensic lab / computer crimes task force that was looking to add people to their personnel. And someone above me at the police department kind of said, there's this computer lab, they're looking to add people. Is that something you'd have an interest in? And I was like, oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's just such a, if you're a little bit of a technologist, it's just like, you can't not be interested in that. And so I started going over, I think it was one day a week for about 3 months. It was kind of your trial period. So instead of, you know, doing my job on the street, one day a week, I would go to this computer lab and just try to learn. And they would set you down in a very supervised way because you don't know how to do anything yet. So they kind of hold your hand through, you know, and they kind of walk you through what a forensic exam looks like. Because it's this sort of really computer forensics. This is, let's see if I can figure out when this was. This is probably 2007, 2008. So computer forensics was still a pretty new discipline. And so the whole industry was in this phase of, do we find cops and trade them to be nerds, or do we find nerds and train to be cops? And so I was the cop first and had a little bit of a nerdy background, but like forensics is a whole different animal. You have to, from the moment you write your first forensic report, you have to be prepared to go in front of a jury and try to explain like binary counting systems, you know, and Windows artifacts and whatever else is involved in your case. So it is, I would call it the equivalent of like a master's degree, to where you have to go through, and it's like the first 2 or 3 years of your career is this, if you don't have a background in forensics or computer sciences, a very intensive drinking through the fire hose process of learning how all of this stuff works. And and the group I was working with, I had the benefit of going through a good amount of training, like right off the bat, because you get access to training through private companies that make the forensic tools that you use, as well as, you know, government entities that put, like the National White Collar Crime Center has like a fundamentals in computer science sort of series where you learn everything. You learn how file systems work. Think of a cop sitting down and having to understand how the FAT file system works, or even worse, how the NTFS file system works. So that you can have an understanding for how these cases. So anyhow, for the next 12 years of my law enforcement career, I was basically a lab rat. Like there was no more 9-to-5 police work. It was like every day I went in and was assigned evidence that was involved in investigations and had to figure out how to acquire data from that evidence and then figure out if it was involved in a crime or if it implicated someone in a crime, or maybe it was exculpatory and showed that they weren't involved in the crime. Because sometimes it works that way too. And it was just an extremely interesting journey, because a big part of it was in 2007, you can probably remember, like, mobile phones mostly didn't have touchscreens. They still had buttons. And in many cases, you still flipped it open when you wanted to interact with it.
Yeah.
So I got to see, I had kind of a front row seat to see phones go from these clumsy things that you have to press the number 7 for 3 times to get a lowercase t or whatever it is.
Yeah.
To the like touch screen,
yeah,
super powerful computers that we carry around in our pockets.
Yeah.
And I think some of that influenced, to fast forward a little bit, how I think about Bitcoin cold storage. And it's been an interesting journey up until this point.
So you start going into doing, is it primarily data-driven crimes? Or like, I mean, how much did you work with financial crimes? Was there any overlap or was there, I mean, I would imagine there'd be some, but.
So at that time, again, I'm kind of a product of the environment at the time, but at that time, Napster was exploding.
Yeah.
And so music is being sort of decentralized. I guess you kind of think of it that way. But peer-to-peer file sharing is also being decentralized. And this was during a period of time where there was an explosion of child exploitive related crime on the internet.
Yep.
Because we went from like, you know, 5 or 10 years earlier to if you had an interest in child pornography, you had to either like physically harm a child or you had to go to some seedy store knowing it was illegal and kind of like drop vague hints. You know, and so we went from that kind of world to anyone with a desktop computer and an internet connection can download LimeWire and suddenly have probably more child pornography than anyone has had access to, you know, in the history of the world. In that period of time, there were a lot of federal and state resources that were being allocated to try and figure out, like, can we deter this? How do we investigate these crimes? Which ones of these are worth prosecuting? And so the majority of my time in forensics, my position was funded by a state grant that was focused on crimes against children.
Yeah.
So 90 to 95% of the investigations that I worked on were everything from more benign stuff like sexting at school. And, you know, one kid sends another kid a picture they shouldn't have. And an administrator sees the phone and they take it and they just want to sort out like what happened to just the most heinous sort of hands-on people who are abusing children and recording that and distributing on the internet kind of thing. So I worked closely with three-letter federal agencies, was on federal task forces, worked very closely with federal prosecutors because all of these crimes, the federal statutes on child pornography are usually sought by investigators because the federal statutes and the penalties for them are more significant.
Sure.
So if you have a guy who's like really deserving of a civic timeout, you might call it, like any sort of crime that involves the internet, a child invokes federal jurisdiction.
Yeah.
One, because the images, you know, cross state lines as they're being acquired and distributed over the internet, but also the computer equipment is typically manufactured in another country and that also invokes federal. So I worked with federal prosecutors quite a bit during my time and it was a really interesting trajectory, not just for a cop, but for someone who does forensics, to have access to the kind of training and resources and to be involved in those prosecutions. And it kind of, it's an interesting perspective because a lot of the cases that I worked on, I didn't have a lot of those ethical dilemmas that some cops legitimately have and some prosecutors legitimately have, where you may feel like you're carrying out laws from a system that you might not entirely agree with.
Yeah.
You know, and there is some gray area to prosecution.
Yeah.
But for the great majority of the crimes that I worked in, like, just people.
It's pretty straightforward. Yeah.
Who are just interested in despicable things and, in my opinion, need to have some sort of consequences from the greater society.
Sure. Let me ask you this, because I've just wondered this. Like, are you having to like sort through these images and like go through and like try to identify places and people? Because like that's the kind of stuff where I'm just like, I know I've read articles of people who are like moderators for Facebook and stuff, and just their existence is sheer misery. I mean, like they have to sort through all these horrendous things you can't even imagine. And so part of me just wonders, like in their case, I think I want to say, I could be making this up. I want to say they said it's usually, I don't think there's actually a rotation from Facebook. It's more like, it's like an assign, it's not an assigned rotation. It's a people quit. People can only do this for so long. Did you experience that? And if so, like, how do you deal with going to work every day and knowing that's what you're seeing, like knowing you're going to be seeing that kind of stuff?
It's a really insidious kind of, the content works on you in a very insidious way that you don't even fully understand. One kind of news story that I kind of followed was It was for YouTube. It was the content moderation team at YouTube kind of went through this sort of discovery process, not like a legal discovery process, but the discovering in practical terms how this stuff works on you.
Yeah.
Because the content moderation people at YouTube, anything that is flagged by someone anywhere in the world, they're supposed to review it and decide whether or not, A, does this, you know, violate the terms of YouTube's platform and should it be removed? And then B, is this something that is criminal in nature and something that we may need to refer to law enforcement? And who does that get referred to?
Yeah.
And so these people viewed everything from the most, you know, violent assaults and murders that obviously YouTube doesn't want on their platform. To legitimate sexual exploitation of children that obviously YouTube and other platforms like that don't want to. So they were exposed to it, and that was their 9-to-5 job. Like you came in and checked in and all right, we're going to review some flagged videos. So they observed certain psychological phenomena in those people over time. Yeah. There are just certain like startle response. I personally experienced this to where, you know, even if I wasn't doing anything related to child sexual assault material or reviewing it, like somebody just walk into my office and I had my back to the door and they'd just say, hey, Sloan. And I would jump and be like, holy crap. Because another thing that they have identified is something called compassion fatigue, to where you have trouble in real life relationships feeling compassion for people because you're just, when you see horrible things happening to people and they seem very real to you because you're watching it in video. You just sit there feeling so horrible for these people. And that translates to kind of like some of your real world relationships. There's one more that's escaping me, but there are these documented sort of psychological effects. And from my personal job, like let's say they hit somebody's house and they seize 3 computers and 2 phones and they go through the process where now they need these phones analyzed and they bring them to the forensic lab. They sit there for a few months because we have a backlog. And then one day when I'm ready to take on a new investigation, I pick up a file folder. It references, you know, some background information about what the investigation is about, what has happened up until this point. And then there are some computers and some phones that are in an evidence locker on site that I go and physically retrieve and unpackage and then start figuring out how I can get data off of them.
Yeah.
You know, usually it's as simple with a computer as removing a hard drive and copying off the data.
Sure.
But then you get into the analysis piece. And of course, because by the time the investigations make it to me, it's usually like a shoe in, you know, shooting fish in a barrel kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you image the hard drive and then you run an analysis suite against the hard drive. And one of the steps in the process of doing a forensic examination for that type of crime is you put eyeballs on every photo that is stored on a hard drive or on a phone. And this, like, it gets to be ridiculous. Like, literally hundreds of thousands of pictures.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
That you have in front of you, if you're efficient, like, you know, in a big screen in front of you with thumbnail size just right so that you can move through it quickly.
Yeah.
And you're just continually scanning. And you kind of go through this mental process of, you know, is it porn or is it not porn?
Yeah.
And then if it is it porn that involves a minor? Does it not involve a minor? And a lot of times, you know, that's a judgment call or a gray area because there are pubescent children that are still obviously not sexually eligible. And so there were days, and it's the same with videos. And there are some ways that you can get through this task, like by building hash libraries of known images that are known images that are bad and known images that are not bad. So you can reduce your workload just by running hash, which is a digital signature, and you can filter out images that are of it, not of interest, and then filter in images that are of interest. And that helped, but there's still just a lot of chair time sitting in front of pictures. The U.S. Attorney's Office is adamant, like, that all the images be reviewed because you never know when you're going to find either an image from a hands-on victim in the case that you're working on.
Yeah. Or another case.
Or of another case, you know, that maybe a suspect on the other side of the country, even the other side of the world, shared an image that has investigative value with your suspect and that could shed some sort of really important light on a related crime.
Yeah.
There were days when it's literally 8 or 9 hours sitting in front of, because overtime is always available, sitting in front of a computer just watching porn. And even if it's like, there's this quote I always think of from Jordan Peterson. It's not really a quote, but it's an observation that he had in that with the dawn of the internet, any male with an internet connection and a computer has access to view more naked women than any other human being previous to him in the history of time. And he could see more attractive naked women in 20 minutes than other men will see in their entire lives.
Yeah.
And you start thinking about like how that works on you psychologically, even if it's not illegal stuff, even if it's just grownups.
Yeah.
But it really like just transforms your perception in some insidious ways. And one thing I can tell you is like a lot of people my age who grew up in the 90s, and I remember the first pornographic image I saw was downloaded from a bulletin board computer. I don't know how familiar you are with that, but like in the 80s and early 90s, there was these, before the internet, there were these local bulletin board systems where somebody would run a server and you could dial in with a modem and access discussion forums or different files. It was like a mini internet all to itself. And I remember downloading pornography then. And like, to be frank with you, like a lot of young men out there, I had a pornography addiction like through my 20s.
Yeah.
And it's funny how God works in these really sort of mysterious ways.
Yeah.
And the way I see like me having been directed into that life of being a forensic examiner working on crimes against children for like 12 years of my life was like God sitting down with me. And it's like when your dad catches you smoking cigarettes and he's like, all right, we're going to smoke the whole pack together and see how you feel after that. And I don't know, you know, obviously not everyone is going to have the same experience that I did, but I can tell you that my job cured me of a pornography addiction that had been persistent through my 20s. Like at some point it was just like, this is really sad and it's ruining people's lives. And even if it's consenting adults, it's just, it's not anything that I want to voluntarily expose myself to.
Yeah.
And that was a process that happened to me over the course of my career doing that. So it was a hard time in my life. As you kind of ask about the effects that that has on you, especially as a young father, like,
oh my gosh,
my children paid a price in some insidious ways. Everything from me just bringing home stress.
Yeah.
Because when you're in that chair viewing that material, it just physically, the stress builds up in you and you just like, if you don't have a good way to release that, like it just, it comes out the wrong way at the wrong times in the wrong direction. But then even like my kids, like when normal kids are starting to do sleepovers and stuff, like how many police reports I read that started out with juvenile A was at juvenile B's house on a sleepover and juvenile B's stepfather or mother's boyfriend was also staying in the house and like bad things happen. It's been an interesting journey, but it also led me to Bitcoin.
The TGFB podcast is brought to you by the TGFB 24 conference. Thank God for Bitcoin 2024 is happening July 24th and 25th in Nashville. This conference brings together some of the best minds in the church, the academy, and in Bitcoin to explore the biblical foundations and daily consequences of how money affects the incentives and outcomes of the world we live in. The name of the conference this year is Render to God, Stewardship, Dominion, and the Economics of Glory. We figured that an election year was the perfect time to examine the relationship between God, government, and money. We'll dive deep into what the Bible has to say about what money is, the role it plays in society, and why the principles governing money creation have such a huge and yet underappreciated effect on every aspect of our world. I'll be speaking alongside pastors and respected Christian figures like C.R. Wiley, Thomas Terry, Eric Hirschman, Glenn Sunshine, and many more. Tickets are limited, so use promo code TGFB24 to save 10% today before prices increase. You can also, for a limited time, if you would like to bring your wife with you, we would love for you to do that. We would love husbands to be able to bring their wives, and so we are offering 80% off tickets for wives who want to accompany their husbands. So that means you can get two tickets today for $300 by using promo code COUPLE at checkout at tgfb.com/store. Go ahead, run over and do that. We'd love to have husbands and wives together to talk about these very important topics. This is a one-of-a-kind community experience at the intersection of theology, technology, ethics, finance, and economics. We hope to see you there. Okay, back to the show. Man, I would love to talk to you for longer on a lot of these points. Maybe just to kind of finish that one off. Yeah, I mean, we have kids and stuff, and so we don't do sleepovers like for this reason, because like you just see all the horror stories, and then you just think of like the cumulative effect of generations of watching. You know, you have the people like you who like praise the Lord. Like in your case, you're like, this cured me of this. Like this allowed me to see this for what it is. To see the lives that are destroyed by it, all that kind of stuff. But then you have the people who like watch it and get hardened by it. you know, and like that just ends up
desensitized
and like just it gets to they just need more and more awful things to get the get the same responses they get before. And so then that just over time, turns into awful things. And then you have just the normalization, like when we were growing up, again, there was still a stigma on it. And now like you have things like OnlyFans that are, just removing even some of the stigma just socially. And so just seeing kids who are getting access to porn and, at just increasingly young ages. And so it's just, just unbelievable to think about and like depressing, honestly, to think about just the cumulative effect of all these things.
It's even something biochemically that we don't understand.
Yeah.
The chemicals that are released in an adolescent boy's brain when he views pornographic material are probably like on par with injecting heroin or, it's crazy.
So as you're working in this field, it makes sense to me. It'd be intuitive that you would come across Bitcoin, but what did your first interaction with Bitcoin look like?
Yeah. So there was another examiner. It wasn't me. There was another examiner in the forensic lab who was working a case. And I've told this story before about a local kid he had an expensive gaming computer that had two GPUs in it. So it had dual GPUs, which is like pretty fancy system.
Yeah. What year is this?
This is late 2012 or early 2013.
Okay.
So it's kind of at the tail end of when you could still competitively mine Bitcoin with GPUs.
Sure.
They're starting to see FPGAs and there were maybe like the very first few ASICs, but it was still, you could still make some decent money mining Bitcoin with GPUs.
Yeah.
And so he was mining Bitcoin with this gaming computer at home. And then he would use the Bitcoin that he had mined to purchase small amounts of weed on the Silk Road.
Yeah.
And then he had those shipped to his house. He would repackage the weed into, dime bags or whatever, take them to school, and he was selling them to other kids.
Yeah.
And of course, a pretty industrious kid, but eventually a teacher or administrator, hears about it or sees it.
Yeah.
And that's how, they call the police and the police investigate. They get to the kid's house, seize his computer equipment, and it makes its way to our forensic lab where this fellow examiner had been assigned to conduct a forensic examination on that computer. And we were just having water cooler talk one day. And he was saying, I got this case that involves this thing called Bitcoin. It doesn't make any sense to me. He asked me, have you heard of it? And I'm like, I never heard of that. Cause I was technically involved, but I was never a cypherpunk. I was never the kind of guy who read Hacker News on a weekend TechCrunch or something like that. A lot of people was their first touch point with Bitcoin was, I forget which magazine, but that was my first touch point with Bitcoin was guys working a forensic examination that involves this weird thing called Bitcoin. And I was at a point in my life where young father and you're trying to financially make your way in the world on a cop's salary.
Yeah.
And so I was looking for investments and I was trying to figure out I bought some equities and was investing a little bit in stocks. At that point, people said they could make a lot of money investing in peer-to-peer loans, like on LendingTree.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was researching LendingTree and trying to figure out strategies there. And so Bitcoin first hit me as this potentially appreciating investment that maybe would go somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I started reading about it on Bitcoin Talk, which was an experience to be involved on Bitcoin Talk kind of at the tail end of its, in the beginning, that was the only place where you could talk about Bitcoin. And they had this very interesting onboarding process where you sign up for a membership. And at first you were not even allowed to post anywhere except for maybe in the newbie form or something.
Yeah.
And you had to you had to spend a certain amount of time logged in, browsing and presumably reading on the platform before you were allowed to even post outside of the newbie form or whatever.
Wow. Man, and that's actually a great idea.
And they actually, it was kind of like a heavily suggested or assigned readings were to go through some of Satoshi's original posts and read the Bitcoin white paper and read of his more famous sort of reflections on Bitcoin. So anyhow, I first started learning about Bitcoin on the Bitcoin Talk forum and everything was so new. The Bitcoin Talk forum was also where a lot of alternate cryptocurrencies first announced that they were launching. So
it's like Ethereum probably. And
No, this was
Litecoin or something
Litecoin. I think the first altcoin, I think was Testnet. Officially Bitcoin testnet.
Okay.
But then Namecoin, I think, was the first.
Oh, really? Okay.
altcoin, which actually had like a certain usefulness to it.
Yeah.
And then maybe Litecoin, and then it started getting crazy from there. But these obscure alternative cryptocurrencies would post a launch thread in Bitcoin Talk.
Yeah.
And so to jump around a little bit, I had started mining at home.
Okay.
And so I had GPUs at home that I would kind of approaching it from maybe like a venture capitalist sort of angle. I would look for these, you know, new tiny cryptocurrencies, and I would mine them for like maybe a week when they first launched and the difficulty was really low, and then just kind of hold on to them a while and see if maybe the price spiked.
Yeah, appreciate it or something.
Yeah. And, you know, everybody, I was mining, I was trying to trade. I didn't know anything about trading. I still don't do trading, but I was trying to do it back then. And just kind of fell down the rabbit hole of what is this Bitcoin? At first, like I thought it was some sort of distributed password cracking engine or the search for extraterrestrial intelligence was a thing back then. So like, what are you running these computers for that consumes all of this computing power? And like, what does that facilitate for this network?
Yeah.
And how does it all, it took me a long time to figure out like why all of this made sense.
Yeah. Okay, so at this point, this is 2012 you started mining, or 2013?
It was probably not till 2013. And that was mining, you know, first with GPUs in the basement. But I remember telling my wife that there was this company that made this thing called a Bitcoin miner, and that they weren't finished making it yet. But when they finished making it, after we paid them like a few $1,000s, they were going to send it to us in the mail. And then we would be able to like basically use it to receive money at home. And like I said, my wife's very understanding, and she actually allowed me to spend, I think, $2,000 or $3,000 on an ASIC made by a company called Butterfly Labs.
Yeah.
Which, weird coincidence, those were actually made on the other side of the state of Missouri from where St. Louis is. There was all sorts of drama because they were selling them before the design was even finalized and before they were manufacturing them. So then it became this like thing where the customers who had given them money were just constantly harassing them online for like, when are you going to start shipping? And there was rumors that they were mining with them before they were sending them out, because at this time the network difficulty of Bitcoin was exploding.
Yeah.
So it made a big difference.
If you missed it by a few days, something like you could miss out big time.
You could be making 10 Bitcoin a day, and then suddenly the difficulty adjustment and you're making 3 Bitcoin a day. So there was, in terms of these machines being profitable or anything, like, of course they all were in the long term, but but at the time it was like a big deal how much difficulty was exploding as more and more ASICs were appearing on the network. And like, it was all like this arms race of who would get access to them first and how many Bitcoin would they be able to mine until other people did. It was like a crazy time.
Yes.
And I always joke that like, I got involved with Bitcoin at the worst possible time, because it was in 2013 as the price was going up to like, I think it was in April of 2013, there was this mini peak of like 250 or 260. Yeah, 260. Yeah. And then it kind of like flagged. But then there was this huge run up in November, December of that year before Mt. Gox collapsed up to like $1,200.
Yeah.
And when you're just getting involved as this happens, it's like, you think the thing's like a rocket ship and it's going to go up forever.
Yeah, no. Oh, man. Yeah, I remember I was way later than you, but my first potential chance of buying any of it was, I had been listening to Glenn Beck, and Glenn Beck was kind of my, he Ron Paul pilled me. Like, I got intro to Ron Paul through him. So he basically was like, yeah, you know, they're going to do crazy things with the dollar. They're just, you know, the debt is soaring, so you should get some silver and gold. You know, this is what you should do. And so I had, I was just like, okay, that makes somewhat sense to me. And so I like took, I believe it was either $2,200 or $2,600. I took it to a gold and silver broker, walked in there, was going to plop down and buy some silver ounces for $23, $24, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And as I'm walking in, I still remember there was like, it was two rooms. It was a pretty small location. It had two rooms. The first room was like the secretary's office. She had one of the, like an old school computer monitor that had a Bitcoin sticker on the back of it. And like, she was all about Bitcoin. And I had heard of it, but it was just like, didn't know anything. And so I walked past her, and I would love to know who she was to this day. I just wish I could go back and get her name, because I wonder if she's still around. But I mean, she had to have, this is 2012, I think, as well.
Right.
So this, she had to have, I mean, just crazy amounts of, but I walked by her, and then there's like the owner. And so I you know, was asking about coins and he was giving me advice. And I was like, hey, so this Bitcoin thing, he goes, it's really interesting, you know? And I think, can't remember what Bitcoin was going for then, but it wasn't much. And I just remember thinking, I remember I did the math of how much Bitcoin I could have bought with $2,200 or whatever. And
ended up getting silver coins instead. It's dangerous to think about that.
Yeah, but seriously, you're like, I would have had paper hands. I would have sold so much of it, you know, like, because right. I had no framework for understanding what it was. It just would have been totally superficial.
Yep, I can relate.
Okay, so then you get into Bitcoin and you start mining. You start, I'm sure, you know, saving in Bitcoin. Like, how long was it before you started getting into, you know, some of the, I mean, were you already like an Austrian sympathizer at that time? Or how long was it before you became like a principled, you know, Bitcoiner?
Oh, it wasn't. Like, I had to go through a whole...
You would do the altcoin phase and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. The altcoin phase was like... And honestly, like, you joke about, like, I never would have held on to it. But, like, that's... So, I put a Bitcoin into the original Ethereum crowd sale.
Okay.
And that's one of those, like, I'm since, you know, reformed. But back then, it was like, there were all these altcoins. Yeah. And I was, like I said, kind of approaching it from this, spread a little money around and see, like, what happens.
And like stocks. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like, that's one of those, like I sold the Ethereum after it had appreciated to me what was a crazy amount, but in the longer arc of like, it's nuts. Anyhow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a reformed altcoiner.
Yep. Yep.
No, it was, I talked about kind of how the price appreciated in 2013. And then there was just a long, dark bear market through 2014. In 2015, especially after Mt. Gox collapsed, that was, you put that on par with FTX, but the reality at the time was like, it was worse than FTX.
That was cataclysmic. Yeah.
Because imagine if like FTX was the exchange that like 90% of people used. It was just,
it'd be like if Coinbase fell today, having all the ETF coins in it and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was the time during which, kind of during 2014 and 2015, that I built, for me, the steel man case for Bitcoin as an investment. Yeah. I still wasn't even wrapping my head around it as like a freedom tool.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a tool for economic empowerment or good in the world. It was just, to me, it was like, if this thing comes back after all of this bad stuff has happened and the price drawdown, I was like, if this thing comes back, it's going to go wild. And so I'm holding through the long bear market and kind of slowly becoming less and less interested in the alternative cryptocurrencies and, you know, buying Bitcoin a little bit along the way, but mostly just holding. I bought Bitcoin from Coinbase. I was probably one of the earlier customers of Coinbase in 2013.
Yeah.
And I remember buying Bitcoin on Coinbase and then selling it on local Bitcoins because there was a little bit of an arbitrage play there too. Until FinCEN started making noise about that being money laundering. And I was like, nope, never mind. That's not worth the risk.
Yeah.
So this gets to the my like lettuce hands moment, I'd call it. So in the tail end of 2016 and then into 2017, the Bitcoin price is starting to come back up. It's finally like we're through this long bear market and the price is recovering. And fortunate or unfortunate for me, depending on how you look at it, we had in 2012, built a new house.
Okay.
And like everybody does when you're young, you stretch a little bit, you know, thinking, and of course the loan officers encourage you to stretch yourself a little bit. Yeah. And so I was feeling kind of not drowning, but I was feeling a little financially weighed down by our mortgage payment.
Yeah.
And we had kids in daycare at the time. So it was an expensive season of life.
Yep.
And so in 2017, as the Bitcoin price is creeping up, I had always in the back of my mind kind of laughed to myself like, oh, if I ever get to the point where I can pay off my house with Bitcoin, that would be like, that would be such a freeing thing. And then early in 2017, not even before the price started to go crazy, but as the price started to get into the lower 2000s, so it's already made an all-time high from 2013.
Yeah.
And it's starting to creep up. And I'm this unexperienced investor thinking like, what if this whole thing implodes? Not realizing like if it breaks the previous all-time high, chances are it's going to run for a bit before, you know, there's any sort of correction. Anyhow, I remember being at work. And I'm constantly doing the math in my head in terms of the number of Bitcoins that I own and what the exchange rate is and how much would I need to be able to get out of it, to be able to pay the taxes and then, you know, pay off our house. And one day kind of at work, it hit that magic number. Yeah. And I remember getting to work and I can't think about anything else but this. And I eventually that morning, I was at work, literally like my heart's racing. And I still remember that day. I just told my boss, I'm going home early. And I took the rest of the day as a personal day. And I went home and took out the paper wallets that I made, you know, a few years earlier. And I just started very awkwardly transferring everything to the exchange I was working at the time. And I didn't even sell in a smart way. Like I just market dumped everything. There's probably it was on Gemini, and there is probably a blip on the daily chart that day on Gemini for me just awkwardly just like liquidating it all. And I remember like after it was all done, at first I was having trouble figuring out, I'd gone through this before, but it had been like 2 or 3 years before. I'm trying to figure out how to sweep these private keys that I had. Yeah. You know, to get access to the Bitcoin to send it into the exchange. And I'm like freaking out because I think I can't figure out how to do it.
Oh, no.
And so I'm like stressing, just really stressing, going through this emotional experience. I remember at the end of the day, seeing the fiat balance in my exchange account and just being like relieved.
Yeah.
Just absolutely and utterly relieved.
Yeah.
Because it was such an emotional roller coaster. So like fast forward a little ways, like we legitimately, and it's a ridiculous amount.
Yeah.
Like for me as a guy paying taxes, like we legitimately paid taxes on the gains and then used the remainder of the funds to, you know, wire to the mortgage company and legitimately like got out of our mortgage.
Yep.
Which was, it's tough to think about, you know, what if I hadn't have done that and I just held on to the Bitcoin, but but like it was a tremendously freeing experience.
Sure, 100%.
To have like that, because if you start to sprinkle in some of the other factors in my life, like I'm at this job where some days I'm just absolutely hating my life.
You know,
because I have to go in and subject myself to this like emotionally draining experience.
Torturous. Exactly.
And so I start to realistically think about like a path out of my job.
Yeah.
And I'm very blessed that my wife, she's always been better at bringing money home than me, and she does reasonably well. And so her and I started to think and talk and pray about like, what if I start thinking about leaving law enforcement and become more of like a stay-at-home dad? And so it wasn't an overnight thing. We took a pretty responsible approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
And for 9 months to a year, we just tried living on her salary.
Mm-hmm.
And we saved mine, kind of thinking like, well, let's just see if we can make the numbers work. And if we can, then this is a real possibility. Just mm-hmm. you can budget things, but like life happens, things come mm-hmm. up. And so we're going through that process. And at the same time, the price of Bitcoin keeps going up and up and up. And
so
when
you sold, you said it was at like 25 or something like that?
It was below, 22. It was like 22 or 23.
22. Okay. Got you.
And so for the rest, this was in like March or April.
Yeah.
So for the next 6 months, it is this relentless climb of the Bitcoin price. And I was the orange pill for a lot of the other guys in the forensic lab that I worked in. So
they're like,
all,
aren't you happy?
They're like, can you believe how much money we're making? And I'm like, I don't want to think about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear about it. Yeah. And I'm also at this point, like I'm trying to mentally prepare myself for, hey, maybe I could be a stay-at-home dad.
Yeah.
So I don't want to think about Bitcoin for the rest of 2017. And I start going through what I would call an intense kind of like self-development cycle where I'm trying to prove to myself that I have the self-management required to not be in a job anymore, but mm-hmm. to like be productive at home and take care mm-hmm. of our kids, trying to like, you know, heal some of the wounds that I'd accumulated as I'm planning to exit from this job and gain a higher degree of financial education
mm-hmm.
and emotional education. So I went through mm-hmm. this period. I was super into podcasts and I was in this like self-help kind of mode
mm-hmm.
and went through some stuff that was really tremendously helpful. I don't currently do it. There was a book called The Miracle Morning that is this, it's a self-help book and it teaches you to get into this daily routine where in the morning you get up and you go through like the same routine for like 45 minutes or an hour every morning before you even start your day or interacting with other human beings. And it's really powerful. It's a combination of meditation or prayer and physical activity and reading and setting intentions for like the things you want to focus in throughout the day and like remembering what's important to you.
Sure.
And, you know, for a time, like I was in that book, in that year, I probably read like 30 books, everything from Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Kiyosaki to like, you may have mixed feelings about Tony Robbins, but he's had some powerful books that have helped me kind of like level up. And so I'm kind of ignoring Bitcoin and going through this period of what I would call accelerated personal growth. And I get to the end of 2017 into 2018, and it's a realistic prospect. We've decided that I'm going to start planning my exit from my law enforcement career. Human beings are kind of drawn to round numbers. So 15 years seemed like a good round number. So I was targeting this 15-year point and planning to leave. And so I mentioned before that we were living off my wife's salary, kind of saving my salary. And so Bitcoin just starts to like nibble at me again. And I start listening to some of the same podcasts. And at that point, Bitcoin had gone from Bitcoin Talk to Bitcoin Reddit. And then Bitcoin Twitter was becoming a big thing. And so I started getting back onto Twitter and following some of the accounts that I'd previously followed. And I'm kind of having act two of my interaction with Bitcoin. And this time it's from a place of like, what is my legacy going to be? What kind of world am I leaving for my children? At that point, like I was very politically conscious at that point in my life. And I'm worried, I'm politically, I'm on the more conservative kind of things. And I didn't like what I was seeing. I think the national debt was up to like 18 or 19 trillion at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I just had concerns about the way that the economy was being intervened in and, you know, what money was worth and that kind of stuff. And so that was the perspective that act two of my Bitcoin life started from. And it was partly me recovering from that embarrassment and pain of I sold all of my Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But as I'm transitioning out of my career, instead of me saving all of my salary, I started buying Bitcoin with all of my salary as I'm getting ready to leave law enforcement. And so I start reaccumulating at higher prices than I've ever paid for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And I'm ultimately going to own much less than I did before, but it's different for me this time around. And this is where the what eventually got called Bitcoin maximalism starts to creep in.
Yeah.
And you realize that how powerful Bitcoin is and how unproductive I would say it is to focus on all these other things that seem more like facilitating mechanisms for scams and fiat games, as I would call them. So I thought, as I'm reaccumulating Bitcoin, I come to the conclusion that maybe a part of the reason why I had such a weak hands experience was that I didn't feel so confident in my cold storage. And I had put a fair amount of time and thought and effort into cold storage the first time around. Like I used a website called bitaddress.org. I got a computer that I ran a live Linux system from that was offline. I bought an inkjet printer that had a USB connection that didn't have any sort of onboard Wi-Fi connectivity that I used to print out the paper wallets with. And I never used that printer again for anything after, you know, using it to set up those wallets. Like I had I'd done what was kind of cutting edge for security in 2013. But over time, people, especially people that, you know, grew up in a more working class environment, they're not equipped for the type of economic gains that's something that's appreciating that quickly.
Yeah.
And the hard thing about paper wallets is like you have to sweep the entire wallet to gain access to any of the funds.
Yeah.
And in your mind, as you start wondering, you go through this, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush kind of thing. And are these financial gains kind of real? Are the private keys that I generated securely generated? Could they have been somehow, you know, so you can check to see if the Bitcoin's there, but it's still until you can move it and, you know, a little bit of out and do a test spend, you're not sure if this financial
gain. I'm getting stressed out thinking about this.
So I think that maybe my Bitcoin storage setup might have contributed to stress that I was experiencing that made me prone to just panic selling everything.
Yeah.
And I'm accumulating more Bitcoin in 2018 and 2019. And I start to think about, instead of this embarrassing episode of having sold everything, instead of that being the end of a story, what if that was the beginning of a story? How can I turn this into a new chapter? And I started thinking about how, if I was going to create a Bitcoin cold storage setup for myself, given my forensic background and some of the things that I observed and some of the basic computer science principles that I've had experience with during my time, what would that setup look like? Mm. So I start researching like what's happening in Bitcoin cold storage at the time. And at the time, multi-sig was just getting to the point where it was practical for someone to use.
Yeah.
Multi-sig at first was this theoretical thing that was really only accessible to institutions. And BitGo was a company that had really pioneered some of the original advancements in multi-sig, but it was only accessible to institutions and exchanges and blah, blah, blah. But these multi-sig tools were starting to become accessible to individual Bitcoiners. And there was a particular tool called Spectre Desktop that was a wallet that was designed especially with multi-sig in mind and to be able to make that accessible to individual Bitcoiners. And so I listened to an episode of the Stefan Levera podcast that was with a guy called Michael Flaxman, who's a security researcher, brilliant guy. And he had written this guide called the 10x Bitcoin Security Guide. If you do an internet search for it, you can still find it. It's hosted on GitHub. And most of the principles in it are evergreen, like cool. In terms of fundamental Bitcoin cold storage strategies. And I read it and I started really becoming attracted to, one, the idea of multi-sig, using multiple keys to be able to protect the Bitcoin that you're holding for the long term. This isn't for like a wallet you're going to spend out of, every week or every month or something. This is for the leaving it to your children's stash.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that appealed to me was it always made me uncomfortable that you had to plug hardware wallets into the computer that you were interacting with. Because from a forensic perspective, it's like there's a data connection there.
Yeah.
I understand that there may be some safeguards in place, but if there's some sort of malicious software on your system or malicious firmware, if you can update the firmware through that USB connection, you can get tricked into doing just about anything if the wrong actors come into play. So I didn't like that USB connection. And I'm also a cheapskate. And this idea of having to spend, let's say you wanted even just a 2 of 3 multi-sig, you have to spend like $150 on each of the hardware wallets. So you're talking like $500. And maybe you're not even sure that multi-sig's for you yet, blah, blah, blah. So this Spectre Desktop also had a DIY tool called the Spectre DIY. Mm-hmm. And it used a development microcontroller board that had a big, nice screen, and you load their software on it, and it becomes this device that they didn't emphasize it at the time, but you could load any private key that you wanted to onto this device.
Yeah.
And when you turned it off, it wasn't engineered to persistently store that key.
Yeah.
And for me, that was a big part of the light bulb moment. So I order the parts and I build the Spectre DIY, and it satisfies my cheapskate because I can use this one device to manage multiple private keys. And another innovative thing about it is you don't have to plug it into the computer to be able to sign a transaction. They use this very clever, novel thing where you transmit data between your laptop, which is the computer that's talking to the Bitcoin network, and this device that just interacts with your private keys. You use QR codes to let those devices talk to each other. And the QR code interface is not to say that nothing could ever maliciously happen through that QR interface, but it's a much elevated bar in terms of the amount of data you can pass through and the type of data you pass through.
Sure.
It's a very satisfying from a security perspective way of separating those two devices. And it gave me access to multi-sig, the Spectre DIY thing. So I started playing around with that. I started interacting with that gentleman, Michael Flaxman, that I mentioned before.
Yeah.
And I designed I've dabbled in 3D printing enclosures, over the course of my 3D printing in the course of my life and designed things. And so I created a printable enclosure for the Spectre DIY that was the first one of those that was widely available. Mm. And as I'm talking to Michael Flaxman, he has this idea for using a Raspberry Pi to create private keys, but a specific version of the Raspberry Pi
What's a Raspberry Pi? People who might not know. You're good.
Yeah. So people first in Bitcoin usually think of Raspberry Pis as this small computer that you use to run a Bitcoin node. Some of the earliest standalone Bitcoin nodes were based on Raspberry Pi. Mm. Over time, they become less ideal for that use case. But it is basically a very compact single board computer, or SBC, which is... Yeah. So this little single board computer is everything that a desktop or a laptop computer that you use has, but it's all in this very compact little form factor.
Sure.
And they make
how big are we talking? Can you show us with your? I mean, just so describe it to us.
Let's see. The flagship version of the Raspberry Pi, so the Raspberry Pi 2, 3, 4 is, well, let's just say like 4 inches by 3 inches.
Perfect. Okay.
And then there's a smaller form factor that Raspberry Pi makes called the Raspberry Pi 0, which is still an entire standalone computer, but it's in this even more compact package that is smaller than the size of a credit card. Wow. And they make a specific version of these little computers that do not have any sort of wireless connectivity embedded in them. They don't have Wi-Fi, they don't have Bluetooth on board, and they don't have any other kind of, you know, means of communicating wirelessly. And Flaxman saw this isolated little computer as a perfect place to generate private keys instead of trusting your hardware wallet to create a private key, which I later learned, you know, is less than ideal, in my opinion. Yeah. You could use, hypothetically, this little Raspberry Pi to take dice rolls to convert them to a private key, or even simpler than that, you take words from the BIP39 word list that are printed out or whatever, and you draw them at random, like a lottery.
Yeah.
And then you would enter them into this little isolated computer, and it would complete, because they're the last word of a seed phrase is what you call deterministic.
Yeah.
And it's used as a checksum to verify the words against it, so that when you're entering a seed phrase into a hardware wallet or some other device, if you mess up one of the words, that last word has to be specific so that it will, it doesn't tell you what you messed up, but it will tell you like, hey, you better look back at what you did. Something's not right here. And so you'd use this Raspberry Pi offline computer to create a seed phrase, including that last word, which is deterministic.
Yeah.
And you would have assurances because it has no internet connection that the private key was kept private, and then you could use it in another device.
Sure.
So he had the idea of connecting a little screen and controls to that Raspberry Pi so you could kind of use it like a little video game system, but you'd be able to enter letters and words into it and the screen would display information. And so I was kind of retired from law enforcement, stay-at-home dad, but I like little projects. And so I was curious to see if I could get something like that working. So I binge-watched Python videos on Udemy for a week. And I'd had a little programming in my history, like I talked about before at the university, but I'd never actually tried to write a program that did anything other than one that was a, you know, to satisfy a school assignment. And so I just sat down with the parts and started with the simplest thing. Like, can I reproduce the demo that comes from the manufacturer for this little screen just to get shapes to appear on the screen?
Yeah.
And slowly over time, you know, it's like, okay, can I recognize input from the buttons and the thumbstick? Yeah. Okay, now can I display words on the screen? Okay, now can I, you know, make the words respond to button pushes? And it was just this very slow incremental process of how do I build this from the ground up? And in a couple of months, maybe, I don't remember exactly what the time frame was, I coded a basic proof of concept that did exactly what he was proposing, where you could enter seed words onto it, and it would tell you what the last word was supposed to be to make the seed phrase a complete valid seed phrase.
Sure.
At the same time, I'm really enamored with the Spectre DIY and I'm tinkering with this Raspberry Pi Zero. And it occurred to me that if I add like a little $3 camera to this Raspberry Pi Zero, I can hypothetically read QR codes with it, which turns it into the functional equivalent of that Spectre DIY.
Yeah. Yeah.
Spectre DIY you could build for like $140 at the time-ish. Yeah. But the parts to make up this Raspberry Pi took it from like $140 down to like $35.
Yeah.
And so you could have this potentially this little device that you could use with multiple private keys that is air gapped. So there's no concerns of an internet connection and that has a screen and a camera. So you can use it to interact with Spectre Desktop or later on Sparrow Wallet.
Sure.
And so I just started, you know, this proof of concept to see if I could make it from just a device that creates seeds into a device that you can use to set up a wallet and then actually start to make transactions on the Bitcoin network.
Yeah.
And it was clumsy and not pretty, but it actually worked. And so I started sharing it on Twitter and then fast forward to the
So this is 2019, you're saying?
I started in late 2020 with this. And then getting into 2021 at the Miami conference, the 2021 Miami conference, which was actually in Miami and not in Miami Beach.
Sure.
Yep. Was the first one where I had appeared publicly and did a brief presentation on this in the open source. It was the Foss stage. Dome at the time.
Yeah.
And it's just been an amazing journey that put me in touch with a couple of our earliest contributors, including Keith McKay, who's right now the lead developer for the Seeds Hunter project as it's evolved. But it's been this tremendous sort of journey of me pulling from my forensic background to think about cold storage and a way of doing it that made sense to me given my unique set of experiences.
Yep.
And then bringing in other people who saw other people independently identifying the merit to this idea and coming in to also contribute to it and to build it into where we are today.
No, man, that is so cool. And again, I've used your product. I've really appreciated it. Actually, we'll give a shout to at Schnitzel. Michael, what is his last name? Oh, gosh.
I know the Twitter handle, but I
Michael, God, it's not Michael Schmid. It might be Schmid. But yeah, I believe he's Swiss. And he's the guy who built the Bitcoin hot tub and like a bunch of different things. But so I was at a small conference this past year, and he just basically said, hey, we're going to be doing seed signer tutorials for anybody who's interested. And so we had, groups of us who were just got around, and everyone got to, go through the whole process of using, generating a seed and then using a QR code with it and stuff like that. So
very cool. That's primarily how people discover like what seed signer is.
Yeah.
Because we're an open source project. SeedSigner is not a company.
Yeah.
So it's just these passionate individual Bitcoiners who build it and recognize the power in it, and then either share it with people at their meetup, or they organize a workshop, or they just post on it, on social media outlets and stuff like that. So that's very cool to hear how you first encountered it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that wasn't the first time I encountered it, but it was just neat to see, again, just as other people who are recognizing the value of it. And again, we've went on a trip together to El Salvador, and like in El Salvador, we were talking about like the way and just the prospect, the opportunity that SeedSigner has as being, because of the low cost of producing it, just the ability for it to be used in all kinds of, different situations around the world, where people maybe don't have $500 to be able to do a multi-sig. They don't have that level of funds, but they can come across $35. They can make things work, with your product in a way some of these other products that are awesome products just they're not able to benefit those people in that way.
And it's funny you mentioned the trip. It was actually that trip. There's a gentleman living in El Salvador. His name is Ronnie Avenando, and he lives close to El Zante there. And really? He, when we were down there, was in the process of opening a retail location called the Bitcoin Hardware Store.
Oh, I did see that. Yeah. I just saw that the other day.
Yeah, they're open, and they've had a little bit more of a presence on Twitter. But prior to going down to El Salvador, he had reached out to me about being able to offer seed signers in the store. And he was approaching it at first from an angle of, I would sell him the hardware, or he had kind of a unique setup for the store where you would kind of lease shelf space. But basically, the way it broke down to was like, I would sell hardware in El Salvador through his store, because I have a little side hustle where I sell assembled seed signers for people who don't have the time or whatever interest to build it themselves. So I kind of flipped it around on him, and I said, I love what you're doing and I want to support this, but what if I help you get started so that you can buy the components, you build them, and then whatever you decide to charge, whatever the margin is, like you get to keep that. And that's the way that I've wanted to see the project develop over time, is just that people in different kind of regional places, these trusted Bitcoiners who have an interest in the project, are able to make it available to the people around them in a more decentralized kind of way. Yep. So I'm super thrilled. He's a great Bitcoiner, and he's started reordering components. And I think he's, beyond, because I met with him when we were down in El Salvador one afternoon at the retail location, before it was finished. And we just sat and talked for a while, and I'd agreed that I was going to give him some hardware to start him out. And I love that he's not just making the seed signers that he's putting together, but he's making all the other, great kind of Bitcoin hardware stuff out there available to people in El Zante, which is, it's a smart location because he gets access to the tourists that are coming to 100%. Kind of on their pilgrimage to Bitcoin Beach.
Yep.
But it's also available to the local Salvadorans who are maybe at the point where they're thinking about cold storage launching stuff too.
Yeah, no, agreed. It's a fantastic, it's a great business model. I'm sure he's not going to be the last, last location they're selling things like that as Bitcoin, again, as Bitcoin's price keeps exploding. But man, I really appreciate your time. And again, hopefully this won't be the last time we have you on. Hopefully we'll, as time goes on, you'll be, the project will evolve, and then, you potentially move into some other things that we can have you back and kind of talk through those as well.
Yeah, that sounds great. And I'm like, you're stuck with me as a listener too. So I'm looking forward to what interviews you have in the pipe are coming up. Yeah,
we've got a number of good ones. So hopefully we'll, maybe when we get off here, I'll give you some insight. But yeah, it's going to be good. So
awesome.
Well, cool. Well, we'll talk again soon. Appreciate your time.
Sounds good. Thanks so much.
Our mission at TGFB is to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. We do this through podcasts, books, consulting services, and live events. We love giving away as much of our resources as possible, but we do have real overhead costs. And there are a number of easy ways that you can help us keep the lights on to continue our mission. First, if you're a Bitcoiner, you can listen to the podcast on the Fountain app and stream us sats in real time as you listen to the podcast. Every contribution makes a difference, no matter how small. You can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/TGFB to receive a number of special benefits available only to our Patreon supporters. If you find these conversations valuable, you can also help spread the word by sharing this episode, subscribing on YouTube, and leaving reviews on Apple and Spotify. Leaving us good reviews goes a long way toward ensuring that the algorithmic powers that be look favorably on our humble endeavors. And finally, engage with us on social media. Join the conversation so that we can build a strong community united around faith, freedom, and sound money. We mentioned the TGFB 24 conference on July 24th and 25th in Nashville. You can go grab your tickets at tgfb.com/store. And finally, go check out julianabarbati.com if you have questions about how to start or better your own podcast. We're grateful for your support, and we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.